This is the Community Forum, a public affairs presentation of the Montrose Broadcasting Corporation. Welcome to the program. It is good to have you with us. 2022 will be the final year in office for State Representative David Millard of the 109th District. And so we've asked him to join us this one last time to update our listeners on issues facing the state, and we'll hear a little bit about his own personal plans as well. Representative Millard, thanks for being with us on the program. Let's begin with a look at your decision to not seek re-election this time around.
Well, the decision, it was a tough one. It was bittersweet. You know, I love the job. I've loved every moment of it. And the greatest reward is at the end of the day when you've been able to help some individual or constituent cut through red tape. Because, as you know, we're not the office of first resort many times. We're the office of last resort when people have tried and failed through agencies to bring resolve to their issue. So getting back to your question, the decision was hard in that respect. It was easy in the other respect that I've served for 18 years at this point, going into my 19th and final year, and wanting to spend more time with family and do some traveling. You know, I'll be 70 years old when my term is complete, or close to it, a couple months shy of it. And, you know, at what point do you say it's time to retire? Well, for me, that decision was made very recently that would be my time of retirement around age 70.
A lot of legislators don't necessarily make that decision, so I'm sure it's not one that you've probably seen around you much.
Well, not too often. It seems that at the conclusion of every two-year session, there are maybe a handful at best. But typically, you see lots of legislators, in a dozen or two, go out usually over a piece of legislation. And I always said that we get a job evaluation every other year, and you want to make sure that there's not some hot button issue that pops up that, you know, takes somebody out, because all the good things that you've voted for and done can be wiped out by voter sentiment on one given issue. And feelings are very strong, especially in today's environment. People are bombarded daily, as all the rest of us, with social media and everything else, where before, maybe not so much, where things would take their time to reach individuals and get clarified before they reach the individual. But today, it's almost instantaneous. And, a lot of the information may not be correct. And, you know, for example, when individuals come into my office, on the same token of having an issue, you know, I always told my employees, listen, we have to be good detectives, because we're only going to get half a story, and perhaps only half of that story is correct. So we have to find the other 75% before we can work on it. And that's the same thing with individuals looking at hot button issues and voting for their legislators.
Sure, that was a learning curve when you came into the job.
Well, it was. And, again, with all this flood of information, people are very sensitive and they have a heightened awareness, whether it's correct or not. And you just have to learn to deal with that and set the record straight.
Speaking of some of those issues, we'll go right to the internet, since that really has changed during your time in office. Like you said, there can be some downsides, but there are upsides as well. In fact, it's become such a part of our society.
Well, we have a great computer system, and you are correct. It's advanced light years since I've been in the legislature. We have systems where we can pull up bills. For example, if you call me about a specific bill, I can get into the database and pull that bill up and get all of the details, again, in an effort to maintain accuracy, and then to provide you accurate feedback on it. Secondly is you'll have the voting record available to you for every piece of legislation by every legislator, not just your own legislator, but you can see whether it was, in fact, along party lines, or, you know, whether one section geographically of the state was opposed to a certain piece of legislation. So there's a lot of information out there that can be gained from it. And, you know, you almost have to be a statistician when you're looking at data banks, because you can tailor the results into whatever fashion you want. And there you have the talking points, pro and con, for a bill. So if you're opposed to a bill, most assuredly you're going to find something in the language that would say that I'm opposed. If you're in favor of the bill, again, most assuredly you're going to pick out those things that are contained in that legislation that are to your liking. And then, of course, your comments would be, you know, tailored accordingly.
As far as broadband and getting that out there, has that advanced?
Well, broadband has made advances in Pennsylvania. However, the rural areas of Pennsylvania is where the deficit is currently. And what we have tried to do was to put some carrots out there, some incentives for private businesses to, you know, apply for grant funding to expand broadband. And I guess the carrot wasn't big enough until the pandemic monies came in, and really an incentive and a push is on to expand it into those rural areas. Once the pandemic hit, it highlighted the fact that if you're going to do remote learning, that you almost have to have rural broadband to enable students to keep up with their, you know, daily lessons. Prior to that, it was with rural business entities. For example, a dairy farm up in the center north of Pennsylvania, in an area that would be underserved and still is to some degree by rural broadband. All these technologies with animal husbandry and, you know, how to monitor the output of milk and all of those types of things, data banks created on the animal population under the care of the farmer, couldn't really be reported or utilized to its fullest because of the absence of rural broadband. Technology is great, but you have to have access to it. So fast forward, the pandemic comes, we find out that schools are being shut down, but we still don't want to interrupt education for our students. So what's the best thing to do? Well, a lot of schools, you know, got very creative and they started doing classes online when they had to do it. But that really highlighted the fact that, you know, we want all education, everybody to have the availability to it. But without rural broadband, dial-up doesn't do it.
And the pandemic has pointed out a lot, forced a lot of changes. Have you seen that? I mean, how has COVID changed the state as a whole?
Well, first of all, when the shutdown occurred, I made every effort to keep my offices open. And we did keep them open. And my employees, to their credit, they came up with all the safety barriers to help us maintain being in the office. Because the first thing that happens during a shutdown, as the governor imposed, is people want to talk to their state legislators, their elected officials, and find out information. What's going on? When are we going to reopen? Am I eligible for, you know, an exemption so that I can maintain my business? All of those questions immediately after the shutdown, I was inundated with phone calls, not only from business owners, but concerned citizens, from school principals, from parents of students. You know, the list goes on and on. So I made every effort to be available in person. Now, we restricted people coming in, obviously, like everybody else, at the onset of the pandemic. And we did it very successfully. We were able to communicate effectively with our constituency. However, what this shutdown did was it really played havoc with businesses. First of all, interrupting production schedules. Secondly, with some businesses that, you know, through this period of shutdown were really unable and or struggling as we speak to get back on their feet. So the government, you know, in their wisdom at the federal level, they came out with the pandemic funding as an assist. The state did somewhat of the same thing. Of course, we don't have all the availability of dollars for those types of things. So the schools, the educational aspect of it, and large businesses got very creative, again, using technology to have people work from home. So we saw a big trend in online learning, online participation, And even we as legislators, we had multiple meetings, and we did it all on Zoom or, you know, whatever other of those social platforms are available. And we were able to do it effectively. However, that doesn't erase the fact that most people still want to get, you know, face-to-face and, you know, be in attendance physically. And that's what we're striving to get back to. It's a long road. We know that with COVID, certainly, that there's going to be other strains of it. And we're seeing clear evidence of that now. Numbers are climbing. We don't know what tomorrow beholds with the severe increase in numbers, whether, in fact, there would be some other mandates put in place or not. One of the mandates that will stay with us for quite some time, of course, is masking. I think that, you know, what we've seen before with people getting vaccinated and, you know, the information coming from the CDC that once you're vaccinated, perhaps you don't have to wear a mask, there may, in fact, be some reversal of that in the future. I don't know. That will be up to them. But at the end of the day, if the simple thing to keep, you know, COVID at bay is to wear a mask, then wear a mask. That's the least intrusive thing that would have to, you know, take place in an individual's life. I think that the drive is to get back to business as usual, but, you know, there are obviously going to be some twists and turns in how we do that.
We used to use the word epidemic to talk about opioids, and that certainly continues as a problem. Give us an update on the opioid crisis.
Well, the information that we've received from a lot of the various entities involved in the treatment of it and those first responders who are exposed to it firsthand has been that during the pandemic, yes, there was some type of an uptick in the numbers of people that, you know, were being administered Narcan. That coupled with the fact that the fentanyl seems to be probably the biggest issue right now with drug use. We don't certainly want anybody, you know, to become addicted or be using. We want everyone to be productive citizens, but realistically, we know that that isn't the case as we speak. But what we're trying to do, even though we've ended the governor's opioid emergency declaration, during the period of time that declaration was in place, extra funds were being directed various ways to what was thought to be the most effective way to deal with it. And so far, there have been some good results. Perfect example is the availability of fentanyl in the event of an overdose. That's one thing. There is much, much more to be done. But, you know, there's a lot of competition for the dollars that come into the state. And although our intentions are noble in every way to combat this, you know, disease that exists within our society, you can't devote every single dollar to it because there are other areas that have a need as well.
And you've got a year to go, but what would be something that you would hope to see, ideally, your dream concluding achievement?
Well, you've already mentioned one, and that's the expansion of rural broadband. You know, I represent rural Pennsylvania. I'm one of the rural legislators. And we define rural Pennsylvania as take the state map of Pennsylvania, put a T-bone stake on it. That T-bone stake is rural PA. One-third of the vote, one-third of the representation in the General Assembly, both the House and the Senate. And, of course, the other two-thirds are Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. So as a rural legislator, you have to learn to work with your city legislators because, again, realistically, you represent one-third. Where those two cities, if they get together, they have the dominance of two-thirds. But what I would like to see, in addition to the expansion of rural broadband, is expanded flood mitigation, flood protection in all of the area that I represent in 109th. You know, certainly Bloomsburg is a community that's been flooded numerous times, and we've made great advances in protecting most of the community. But our largest portion of the community and Fernville, right across Fishing Creek, is yet to be protected. So that's on my to-do list to try and bring to fruition. And then every community that lies along both branches of Fishing Creek and the river, there are certain low-lying areas that, you know, are susceptible to floods. Understanding that every storm event has its own definition, its own characteristic, You never know how much water is going to be dumped over one given geographical area. But there are certain things that we know that are trends, and we can look at those areas to, you know, provide pressure relief points for flood water and heavy rain events. And that, you know, keeps families together, that keeps homes intact, and it keeps communities alive and thriving. And that's the goal. That's my goal, to keep our communities healthy and protect the citizenry. And then in addition to that is to, you know, consistently, I have promoted economic development. Our business taxes are some of the highest in the nation, and there has to be a return on those dollars to provide those businesses the path forward financially so that they can succeed. You know, we want all of our friends and neighbors and family to be gainfully employed. So we want job retention. And in addition to that, we want job creation. And how do we do that? We do that through different incentives that provide that financial footing or foothold, if you will, for businesses to take that challenge.
With that, I kind of move to the fact that you're also leaving the Bloomsburg Fair Board.
Well, my term at the Bloomsburg Fair will end the first weekend in January, when the new director of the area that I serve is elected. I've served on the fair board for 26 years, and there's over 100 fairs in Pennsylvania, all of which are economic engines in their own communities, in addition to supporting our youth through 4-H and FFA. And most certainly the Bloomsburg Fair has been, you know, right there among the best of their support for our youth. And when we look at the economic engine, you know, there are many benevolent groups that participate at our Bloomsburg Fair. And those dollars that they raise, Kiwanis, Rotary, Lions Club, and the list goes on and on with churches and other entities, those dollars stay right there in their community. They are able to do wonderful programs with the dollars that are made during the week of the Bloomsburg Fair. So that's a quality of life issue as well. So, you know, with respect to the fairs, I've enjoyed every moment of it, every moment of, you know, supporting the arts and crafts, and being president also of the Barton House Historical Association, which is an offshoot of the fair, and promoting craftsmen and, you know, all of the things that they are able to do and show us that were done 100 years ago. So it's a fun learning experience, watching them create items, all of which, you know, can be had by anybody going to the fair. Just take the time to walk around and look at all these wonderful things. And of course, the Bloomsburg Fair offers, you know, a lot as far as a variety of food, again, by a lot of benevolent groups. So don't walk around hungry.
State Representative David Millard of the 109th District has been our guest on today's WPGM Community Forum. We appreciate him joining us, and we're glad you, the listener, took the time to tune in. This has been a presentation of the Montrose Broadcasting Corporation. The views expressed on the Community Forum by our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the moderator, staff, or management of this station.